Thanks for your attention. So today I'm going to talk about some of my experiences operating Coral CDN over the past 6 years. I won't actually introduce many new technical details, but hopefully the reflection on its deployment will expose some interesting challenges. So as a very quick overview, the goal of Coral was to make desired content widely available through cooperative content distribution, regardless of the publisher's own resources. Coral builds such resources into a self-organizing network of web proxies that cooperatively share their caches. So when a client resolves a Coral URL through DNS, it learns about a core proxy, which either serves the URL from its local cache or uses a distributed index to find content cached elsewhere in the network. In this case, the proxy downloads the content, returns to the client, and subsequently becomes a source for others. But the important thing of all these steps is that requests to the origin domain are minimized given this cache cooperation. Now, I just said that a user accesses Coral CDNs by requesting a special URL. In fact, it could be used to serve and cache any content by appending a special suffix to the original URL's domain. Accessing such a URL will result in the steps that I just described. Now, this so-called coralization of URLs can be done by a variety of parties, explicitly by clients, by servers that effectively want free content distribution, or by third parties who post coralized links to sites like Slashdot or Dig. In fact, many of you might have used Coral. It might be through browser plugins that allow one to resurrect a seemingly unavailable website, or through explicit links on Slashdot, or you might not have been aware that you're using it. For my Indian friends, this is to watch a Tamil version of YouTube, a video of how to dispose of dead whale carcasses, or on a more somber note, to witness amateur video of the Asian tsunami before YouTube actually existed. Or finally, to download digital artwork, here showing user-generated flame fractals. So after serving this content for years, I actually only recently found out that the digital artist behind it is none other than the brother of Microsoft's own Rich Draves, who I'm not sure is here today. But anyway, these images are just meant to give you an inkling of the variety of use that Coral gets. To give a sense of its scale, this figure shows the number of HTTP requests per day that it has received over the past 6 years with the y-axis and log scale. Know that these faint gray lines box out some time periods in which we unfortunately have either completely or partially missing data, hence the jagged jumps in the trace due to bugs in the logging infrastructure. It's a real system, what can you say? Anyway, the takeaway is that Coral currently receives about 50 million requests per day from 1 to 2 million users. These requests constitute about 2 terabytes of traffic for content from tens of thousands of origin domains. Note that this 2 terabyte is actually a limit placed on Coral by its deployment platform, as Coral runs on about 300 to 400 servers on the PlanetLab testbed. Now, this deployment on PlanetLab was initially one of convenience, as Coral's architecture was designed to be self-organizing and scalable based on an underlying peer-to-peer distributed hash table. From the more peer-to-peer sense, Coral made a few contributions. It changed the basic DHT routing to support weakened consistency and to prevent hotspots. It organized this DHT layer into a hierarchy of locality-optimized clusters that lookups and transfers use nearby peers whenever possible. And it used a structure to build this network of HTTP and DNS servers that could leverage its locality properties. But this talk is actually not about Coral specifics, although I could certainly do that. Rather, I want to talk about the bigger environment in which it operates, and perhaps have more applicability to other services then. So when we design and build systems, we often consider their internals, and that's most of our focus. In practice, of course, they exist in a much larger ecosystem. In Coral CDN's case, this includes legacy web clients, as well as the web servers at origin domains from which it pulls content. It also includes the very machines on which the software runs. On PlanetLab, this includes a virtualization layer that mediates access between multiple so-called slivers. So it's these interactions with the wider environment that I want to focus on today. They are often overlooked in research projects, and they commonly create the greatest practical challenges. They did so indeed for us. Specifically, I want to focus on two things. In the first half of this talk, I want to discuss our experiences in three classic big-picture themes of systems: naming, fault tolerance, and resource management. I should admit this will be somewhat of a whirlwind tour. Real deployments touch on many things in many areas, but there are also many more experiences and anecdotes described in the paper that I won't be able to go into today. But in the second half, I actually want to analyze the appropriateness of Coral's design. Was it stupid to start with? So let's get to it. For each of these areas, I'm going to try to touch a little bit on both successes and failures. So with naming, first the positive. Perhaps the most important aspect of Coral's use was the adoption of its naming interface as actually a programmatic API. Now, our initial mental model of Coral was that some server operator would be hacking HTML directly to manually insert .nyu.net onto the end of all the domains, all the URLs in the website. This turned out really not to be the case. Now, for sites that explicitly adopt Coral, we found actually most use it for larger embedded or linked content like multimedia, as opposed to actually top-level HTML pages. After all, these multimedia objects are actually where most of the bytes are, and they turn out to be the common bottleneck, especially as they relate to billing costs. So our server customers then often integrate Coral through actually server-side rewrite rules, where they handle the initial request, but then use HTTP redirects to send the client to Coral for the content. So shown here is actually the complete set of Apache mod rewrite rules needed for this, including both the actual rewrite command, as well as the check to ensure that Coral proxies themselves can fetch the content directly. Otherwise, you could cause looping. So perhaps more interesting, however, is the ability to express even finer-grained policy. So here, we see a few extra rules that some sites added. These say to redirect clients to Coral if and only if they're referred to by /.dig or blogspot. Now, these particular rules presuppose that only a few static sites could actually cause an overload. So what we found was some enterprising sites began actively monitoring their load through additional server plugins, such that when load exceeds some high watermark, they began redirecting traffic through Coral using these rewrite rules. And after some time, when load drops below a low watermark, they began serving requests directly again. So what this behavior is actually is a network parallel to surge computing with public clouds. Here, instead of moving computation to the cloud, sites were elastically expanding and shrinking their use of this public content distribution service. Now, this naming technique provides an open API, and we've since seen some services use the same technique for composing services together. But this actually exposes a problem. Domains are simultaneously used for many different purposes with the web. So first, they tell you where to retrieve content by resolving an IP address. This is the indirection layer that Coral uses. Second, they provide a human-readable name to help with identifying what looks like a valid URL. So Coral, unfortunately, doesn't do very well here, and we've received our share of abuse complaints where Coral was mistaken for being a phishing site. Although in practice, this is less of an issue for this embedded content I was talking about. But perhaps most importantly, these names are used to define security policies within the browser. So to understand that, let's go to Web Security 101 for a minute. So web browsers enforce access control restrictions through what is known as the same origin policy, which is what allows web objects to access common state only if they belong, if and only if they belong to the same domain. So evil.com can write an evil cookie, and target.com can write a target cookie, but ne'er the twain shall mix, even if one is loaded inside a frame of the other. Now, if these sites share a common suffix, they can access common state and even modify each other's DOM. Now, Coral in practice reduces some of this risk by not supporting posts, header cookies, or SSL, and thus avoiding a lot of use that actually requires a login and more personalized information. But this isn't a great solution, certainly not. The problem is that while the same origin policy matches the fully qualified domain name, it has a special exception for a domain TLD fragment like nyd.net. Now, in the paper, I discuss one solution that I think better obeys this principle of least privilege and allows an on-path proxy to explicitly constrain the default security policy by specifying a less permissive fragment, such as a longer domain.nyd.net. I don't mean this, however, to be a final solution, but I want to point out that indeed some problems do exist with name conflation, we should be aware of them, but also that some potential solutions do exist. So second, I wanted to talk about some of the challenges with fault tolerance, specifically the ability for a system to decouple itself from failures downstream. This is a common goal among complex distributed systems, and Coral actually does a pretty good job recovering and managing internal failures, whether within the distributed index, at DNS or HTTP nodes, or even when management service returns erroneous commands. On the flip side, the system has faced significant challenges in decoupling itself from external failures. Some are a limitation of the deployment environment. PlanetLab doesn't support layer 2 recovery tricks, and browsers don't recover well from failed IP addresses. But some limitations are more fundamental, such as Coral CDN's interaction with flaky origin sites. After all, origins require overload protection precisely after they're already one foot in the grave. So consider an example when slashdot happens, and Coral doesn't yet have any data. The origin site could be unresponsive, it could return an error, or either return a truncated or very slow download, or a correct response. So what should Coral do? So one optimization is well known, has been used by DNS servers for a long time. Cache negative results prevent overload from retries. But it seems like otherwise, if you don't have the data, you can't really do much else. What happens, however, if the network already has an expired copy of the content? Coral actually finds itself with very short TTLs quite regularly. The key point is that stale content is better than nothing. So Coral will return stale content if it otherwise wouldn't be able to revalidate it. And in fact, we extended our API to allow origins to specify maximum staleness in HTTP headers. So even more important is not to replace good content with bad, so that we can continue to serve slightly stale content. This is why we don't overwrite stale content with error codes. But what about seemingly good replies that are truncated during transfer? So here, we turn to using whole file overwrites a la AFS so that new versions are written to temporary files until they are successfully finished downloading. In general, there's a theme here, which is maintain the status quo unless improvements are possible. We see this in a variety of other places with Coral, but this is exactly what the goal of failure decoupling often is. Now the downside. This actually isn't a panacea, as it requires us to correctly identify failures. You'd think this would be an easy problem, but too often a server will respond with a type 200 message, which is machine readable for OK, with a human readable message that says an error was encountered, such as this website did. So now we've unfortunately replaced good content with bad and lost our ability to help out this poor website. So I actually don't have a clean solution here, but certainly better language defaults would help. The ease of PHP means many more developers are dynamically generating web pages, often very not spec compliant, and the language defaults to response code success, which only exacerbates this problem. So let me actually look at the final traditional systems problem I want to talk about, which is resource management. I'm going to talk about some algorithms we developed to better manage proxies bandwidth consumption, but also to point out their limitations without better visibility and control over lower level physical resources. So first, a bit of a timeline again. Core was initially released in March 2004. In August 2004, it was slashdotted. Note the sudden spike in its usage. In December 2004, the Asian tsunami struck, and Core was used to distribute the videos. Its traffic surged, as did Planet Labs. A site threatened to pull its servers, and because, of course, Planet Lab didn't want this, just launched an internal discussion about resource limits for Planet Lab services. Now, nothing at the time was available on the platform, so we were actually to curtail our own resource consumption. It was, after all, perhaps a more trusted time with Planet Lab. So the question we had is, how do you handle any problem where demand is greater than supply, which is the problem we had? You either, one way is you raise prices to lower demand, that's the classic economics argument, and this is what commercial sites can do. Another way is you build out infrastructure to increase supply, which commercial sites can also do. We unfortunately don't have that benefit, so we have a fixed supply, and I guess we could play the goal of then another view of economics, which is we want to try to maximize our social welfare by fairly distributing resources. And so this is what Coral does by allocating its daily bandwidth across origin domains and rejecting requests for domains that exceed their fair allocation. So to compute long-term fair allocations, Coral keeps track of the bandwidth consumed by the top 100 domains as exponentially weighted moving average, and this is what's illustrated in this picture. The challenge is to ensure that the total demand remains less than this available supply. To do so, we need to find some dynamically calculated steady state rate per domain such that each domain's maximum consumption is upper bounded by this rate, which is shown by lambda. And in doing so, this lambda chops off bandwidth for the hogs until the total sum of demand can be satisfied by the supply. This is integrating under this curve. Now, this doesn't account for all bandwidth. Remember the heavy tail? So Coral actually does some extra accounting across all domains to ensure that the total consumption doesn't exceed either some steady state or peak rates. The specifics are in the paper. But what we're able to do by using this is to ensure fair resource allocation using long-term averages. And so we could see that these actually algorithms turned out to work pretty well in practice. This graph shows the total number of requests per domain per day on a log-log scale. And the scatter plot in blue shows the number of each of these domains' requests that were subsequently rejected. So note that object size plays a rather large role here. The second most popular domain used Coral to distribute relatively small images, and therefore only 3.3% of its requests were rejected. The third most popular domain were for these 5 megabyte movies of these flame fractals, and 89% of their requests were actually rejected. Now, all told, the demand on Coral across all nodes peaks around 10 terabytes, while it preserves its daily consumption under 2 terabytes. Now, the trusted deployment model on PlanetLab only went so far. So PlanetLab deployed its own lower layer bandwidth throttling a little more than a year later. So what we actually have now is a mismatch between layers. Coral's solution to restricting bandwidth consumption was admission control, where requests are rejected if the consumption was too high, while the platform solution for bandwidth shaping is bandwidth shaping in the kernel in order to limit the overall rate. But not only are they using different hammers with the same goal, but they are basing their decisions on fundamentally different information. Coral is tracking only HTTP traffic, while the kernel is tracking all bytes, packet headers and retransmissions certainly, but also DNS and DHT traffic, log transmissions, etc. And this difference turned out to be significant. When I looked through logs, I found that Coral was hitting just around its target of 2 terabytes a day, but this was only about 1/2 to 2/3 of the total traffic that its slice was sending out. So this means that the kernel bandwidth throttling was kicking in on some servers and degrading system performance. So I either need to be overly conservative, or I can be live dangerously and occasionally get dinged by the system. On the other hand, if I knew when I was close to reaching a limit, the system could better react and perhaps even take some action to prefer some types of traffic over others. For example, DNS and DHT traffic has priority because it's much more latency sensitive than HTTP traffic, which in turn is much more important than log backhauling. So I'd like to argue that these type of virtualization platforms should provide greater visibility into the real-time local analytics, but also finer-grained control over resources to higher-level applications. Both of these can actually be quite difficult to do purely in user space without the appropriate lower-level support. Okay, so I've talked about some experiences interacting with the wider environment, and what about the appropriateness of its high-level design? To evaluate this, let's actually turn to some data. Abstractly, we see 4 types of usage with Coral. The first 2 are for unpopular content, random surfing, trying to circumvent censorship restrictions, or remember that Resurrect This Page plugin. So these cases are the heavy tail of a request distribution graph. Here we see the number of requests per unique URL, sorting by decreasing popularity in log-log scale. Note that I've actually used data from the same date in 2005, 2007, 2009. The distribution pattern is actually rather consistent across years. But for these 2 cases, Coral really doesn't serve much purpose. It doesn't provide strong durability by design for resurrecting old content. And caching unpopular URLs doesn't help either the client or the server. So these 2 things seem out. Now, if we look at the head of the graph, we see popular content. But this doesn't actually tell us by itself if this popularity is due to flash crowds or to stable traffic patterns. So this is what we're trying to look at here. Now, the question is, if a domain is popular one day, how much does this change over time? So here we look at a 9-day trace and generate the set of all domains that were in the top 5 in at least one of these days. And this graph shows the request rate over time. So 3 of these domains experience, on the bottom, experience 2 to 6 orders of magnitude changes between days. However, 6 of these domains were stably popular every day. These are Coral's long-term customers. So let's actually first look at these stable domains. So we saw that we had a ZIPF distribution of URL popularity, and we found that the most popular 0.01% of URLs satisfied fully 50% of requests, and yet only require 14 megabytes of storage. The top 1% cover 85% of requests, and yet require less than 4 gigabytes. Now, the disk cache I have on PlanetLab is a somewhat sad 3 gigabytes, but more modern capacity shows that this workload is highly cacheable on almost a single node. And indeed, we saw really high local hit rates in practice. 70% of requests were satisfied locally, and only 7% of requests used inter-proxy cooperative transfers. Note that this 12% error rate is actually largely due to our admission control algorithms. So now, before we return to consider the implication of this, let's actually look at the fourth type of traffic, which is flash crowds. So we saw before that flash crowds exist, but the question is, how flash are they? So some of Coral's algorithms were designed particularly for reacting very quickly by using optimistic references and cut-through routing to create these dynamic multicast trees. Now, there still are a few race conditions in the DHT that might lead to repeated origin requests, so you might want to ask, how much necessary are future optimizations? So as an anecdote, here we see the same week-long trace, yet now we're looking at minute-by-minute request rates for two particular domains that we saw experiencing a type of flash crowd. In both cases, we see an initial rise, that's the flash crowd, highlighted here in yellow. Traffic trails off before there's another temporary increase in interest 24 hours later, expressing the diurnal pattern of interest. But the more interesting data is in these original regions shown in yellow. So here, we zoom in on these two regions in these subgraphs. Now, remember that each data point represents 1 minute. So when we actually count the number of data points leading up to the rise, we see that sudden flash crowds still take around 10 minutes to increase by 2 to 3 orders of magnitude. Certainly not the 5 seconds that people might be worried about. Now, obviously, these are just two examples. So let's actually look at a wire trace. Now, the paper actually has more complete graphs and analysis, and I just want to summarize a few data points. So here, we look at how much a domain's request rate will vary over time. If we consider 5-second epochs, only a quarter of them have any domain whose rates increase by a factor of 10, and only 0.006% of epochs have a domain that increased by a factor of 100. On the other hand, virtually all 10-minute epochs have at least one domain with a 10x increase, and 28% increase include a 100x increase. So in short, request dynamism certainly exists, but on a slightly longer time scale, and stable traffic is still dominant. So let's summarize. Most requests correspond to long-term popular content, and so far, this working set can fit into each node's cache. Flash crowds do exist, but on the order of minutes, not seconds, and they currently account for a relatively small fraction of requests. Now, there are two conclusions one can draw from this. The first mirrors the finding of Woolman et al. From UW that says there are diminished returns for cooperation. There's not much benefit for doing so. So in Planet Lab, one could imagine a very different system, one in which focuses on long-term popular data and has little or no cooperation between proxies. There goes our DHTs. The second, perhaps more contrarian viewpoint, hopes to return to the original goal of Coral. What the previous argument said was that there's not too much client benefit to cooperation. Cooperation still does minimize the total number of requests to the origin server. And that's the claim that Coral initially made. So in Akamai, for example, each of its 1,000 or so clusters will independently pull in the content from the origin site. Now, this works fine for Akamai's origin sites because they're well-provisioned commercial systems. This is not often the case with Coral. So instead, why not turn to this global cooperation as a form of insurance policy? The default is to use just regional cooperation, but if the origin is overloaded or unavailable, the global index can be then used as a backup plan. And so finally, I want to point out how Coral's design was extensively flexible to support these changes. I vaguely mumbled earlier that Coral's index is based on a locality-preserving hierarchy, where nearby neighbors cluster together. It was actually rather straightforward to import policy that restricts initial lookups based on this regional clustering, and then only use global clusters as a failover from the origin. So we've actually been running this system on half of Coral's network since September 2009, and we found that medium lookup latency in the live system decreased by an order of magnitude, while origin load only increased by 5%. Now, this failover was still actually useful. It was applicable in fully 1 out of 200 origin requests. So we can actually improve performance while basically still maintaining resilience. Now, the final point is whether we could promote Coral's use for flash crowds, because right now, popular content is dominating its traffic, and it really doesn't have enough bandwidth to go around. So use it for flash crowds rather than just basically a free CDN for popular content. So the fairness algorithms we developed for fair sharing actually can be used for exactly this. The big difference is how we then want to weight historical information. The heavier weight we placed on history, the more that flash crowds can temporarily peak before their levels are curtailed to a relatively low steady state rate. And so I actually think that there's hope for it yet. So to review, many of Coral's challenges arose from the interaction with the real world, not due to its internal system designs. I touched on its benefits and limitations in some classic systems problems, namely naming, fault tolerance, and resource management. I also revisited Coral's design. One conclusion is that the current design is unnecessary and overly complex for most of its current usage, and I certainly would concur. On the other hand, it does benefit flash crowds, and I describe some easy changes to better balance performance in the normal versus exceptional case, as well as techniques by which we could prioritize flash crowds. Now, if we truly want to reach internet scale and realize Coral's original goal of so-called democratizing content distribution, we need a lot more bandwidth. Now, this suggests opening this up and moving off of Planet Lab. But a central reason we stuck with Planet Lab was that beyond convenience, there are real security risks with untrusted proxies and their ability to maliciously modify content. So in order to achieve both end-to-end security and internet scale, we finally decided recently to bite the bullet and explore explicit client-side adoption and give up one of the transparency goals of our original system. So I'd like to end by actually publicly announcing an initial beta release of a next system, which is a browser-based peer-to-peer web CDN, which we, not surprisingly, called FireCoral. You could download and install today as a browser plugin for Firefox, and it will cooperatively share select portions of browser caches. So thanks for your time. I'm happy to take any questions.
Hi, Sanjay from Purdue. I want to begin by congratulating you on this paper because it's very hard to write an experience paper.
I would concur with that also.
Okay. So I had I noticed you haven't talked much about user performance. Have you done anything like conduct user surveys to see what, to report on what the user experience has been with the system?
So we don't have that data. It's relatively hard to collect. So I should say that I made an explicit decision at the beginning of this not to actually provide a good quality of service and not to open myself to support costs, that is, dealing with requests from users. Because I think if you want to be a one-person shop and kind of run a system, it would quickly dominate all your time. So in some sense, my answer is that performance sometimes can get not very good, but that users get what they pay for. And that I actually explicitly try not to really go crazy in optimizing performance because I think it would be a never-ending spiral of, sucking up all your time.
I see.
So I don't really have an answer to that, though.
Okay, second question is, to keep a system running for 5 years, there must have been a lot of, what were the number of man-hours you needed to do to maintain the system?
So right now I spend about 10 minutes a month. You, again, get what you pay for. It kind of runs, and the only 10 minutes are basically occasionally abuse complaints that Larry gets bugged with, and then he bugs me, and I respond to them. I think this was because it was really neat. It was really useful how the original architecture was designed to be this self-organizing algorithms. So nodes die. The system doesn't care. It just reacts to it. We do have one bit of centralization in the system now, which is basically a management interface. And all that does is basically pushing, I have a web interface where I could click start, stop, kill, restart. But I rarely ever touch that, possibly, again, because I don't do a very good job performance tuning. Certainly, there was a time at the beginning where it was a significant amount of effort. The original Coral paper was probably around 10,000 lines of code. The current is probably around 50,000 lines of code with maybe 10,000 lines of various scripts. So there's a lot of stuff that went into it, but right now it basically just runs itself.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Hi, Mike. I wanted to sort of ask you more questions about the result, which I found fascinating, that a quarter of the flash crowds actually are fast and the remaining are not as fast, right? A quarter of the flash crowds take 5 seconds to ramp up. And in particular, my question is sort of, can you tell us more? Why is that? What are the trends? Are we going to see the same trends 2 years from now? Why are flash crowds behaving like that?
Okay. So previously extracted some numbers. It's actually a richer policy. I mean, the last graphs I was showing were, did there exist one or more domains with flash crowds? I guess probably not going to go through to describe is what basically, you know, what is not the only interesting question is, does there exist a domain that has a flash crowd, but the prevalence of domains that has flash crowds? And I just wanted to point out that this data is in the paper. Now you're... Could you actually repeat what your actual question?
Okay, so basically you found some sort of diversity across flash crowds. There are flash crowds that actually ramp up very quickly, and there are flash crowds that ramp up slowly. So my question is, sort of, can you tell us more? Why is that? Are these trends going to stay the same 2 years from now? Or, like, sort of, what are your instincts there?
So, unfortunately, I probably don't have a good answer to this question. I think a lot of it is just... randomness of the web. You know, this has a large coverage, and it just is used by a lot of a high variety of sites. And certain now, I have different types of traffic of two types of data in the system. One is I want to say how many domains are flash crowd, but also what fraction of the total request rates correspond to those domains. Now, the other question about analyzing individual things, it's one of the reasons why I don't have a better answer, perhaps, is that the amount of data that we have, I mean, even if we're talking about 1% here, this is 500,000 requests I need to look through. So, in general, I can't answer that question, and part of it is the...
Okay, let me ask you a simpler question.
Perhaps we could take this offline.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.